This is Cody McLean from the Mind Hack Podcast, a place where we explore the routines, mindset, and experiences of successful people in their field, whatever that field may be. Today, we're looking primarily at psychiatry, adult ADHD, and mindfulness. These topics are relevant for adults who are looking to manage their ADHD with meditation and other mindful activities. My guest today is Lydia Zalowska, an MD who is also a board-certified psychiatrist. Dr. Zalowska has expertise in integrative psychiatry, adult ADHD, and mindfulness-based therapy. At UCLA, she conducted pioneering research on the effects of mindfulness with ADHD. She is also the author of The Mindfulness Prescription for Adult ADHD, a book which was awarded the distinction of 2012 CHAD's Most Innovative Program. As somebody with ADHD, I've constantly struggled with finding out how I can be more productive, focus better, and simply not feel like a giant heaping mess all the time. I picked up Lydia's book a few years ago and found it to be an incredibly insightful deep dive on how powerful the effects of mindfulness-based therapy can be. And I've still been practicing some of her techniques to this day. In this interview, we detail the difference between meditation and mindfulness, ways to practice mindfulness if sitting still is a challenge, whether ADHD drugs are necessary, and the origins of ADHD. Lydia shares some of her favorite resources for adult ADHD and also discusses mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. This was a great interview looking at multiple facets of what it means to have ADHD and so much more. So without further ado, please welcome Lydia Zalowska. What is mindfulness?
So mindfulness is something that people describe or define in different ways. You know, my favorite way of thinking about it is that it's a specific way of interacting with your experiences. And that specific way has to do with a shift in attention and a shift in attitude. So there are these two steps to how you become mindful. And so bringing attention to the present moment, and there are lots of things in the present moment, outside or inside, and doing it with the attitude of curiosity, openness, and we often say non-judgmentally. So trying to be receptive as opposed to, you know, analyzing what I'm experiencing, criticizing it, judging it, and maybe even pushing it away.
Right. And that's an issue I've had for as long as I've been alive, as somebody with ADHD, and that has struggled with everything from being motivated to being focused and finding that it's so easy for me to get distracted. And I started meditating maybe 5-6 years ago. I just through the app Headspace, I'm sure you've heard of it. And the first example I give about my experience with meditation is I would always get up and go grab a snack. And I did this for years. And I never asked myself, why am I getting up to go grab a snack? And after I started meditating, I asked myself, wait, why? And I looked at my computer and I realized that it was an email, it was a task, it was something that I did not want to do, that there was a huge mental just anxiety around it. And then I was able to consciously say, okay, I'm not going to grab a snack. I'm going to sit back down. And that's the first example I can convey about my experience with being more mindful about those anxieties that would come up throughout the day.
Yeah, and that's a great example because you touch on the fact that, you know, mindfulness is often trained in meditation. It's a specific type of meditation, and that formal practice of, you know, sitting still and noting things moment by moment can really then develop this capacity or this ability to be more aware in daily life and start questioning the things that you would automatically do, and gives you a choice. So like you were able to ask that question or be more aware of, you know, I always do this, why? And what are some maybe triggers for this? And realizing that there is a choice. And that's such a, you know, big thing for all of us. We all do things out of habit, automatically, maybe things that are kind of our go-to coping strategies that are not always the best, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So having some more awareness, more spaciousness and choice around it can really create freedom in your life.
And now on that note, do you think everybody needs to meditate in order to achieve that level of mindfulness that you're referring to?
No, I think of mindfulness more, I like to use the term mindful awareness. And mindful awareness can be cultivated in different ways, or you can learn about it in different ways. You know, meditation is one of the kind of classic and quite effective ways to do it. But, you know, you could do psychotherapy and become more aware and mindful. You could do some journaling, writing. It could happen through reading books and really reflecting and questioning, you know, asking questions as you learn. And, you know, awareness can also, you know, be because other people give you feedback, people in your life, or being open to what friends are telling you. And just general attitude of curiosity. I do think some people are more naturally mindful, and it may be more of a temperament trait. Others may be more challenged in that way, but anyone can, it is a skill. Anyone could learn more of it.
So when you start, you were a associate professor at which college?
So I'm assuming you're asking when I first started this work in mindfulness and ADHD.
Exactly. How did you pair that aspect of psychiatry and go into this realm of mindfulness?
Yeah. So I was training as a psychiatry. I was a psychiatry resident at UCLA. And my first kind of step in this direction was that I became interested in complementary alternative medicine. I had a chance to rotate in a clinic that incorporated Chinese medicine into Western medical context. And that really made me curious about different ways, cultures, and systems of medicine approach symptoms. You know, that Chinese medicine would look at a person very differently than Western medicine would look at a person. And I think this was an introduction and kind of this perspective taking. And I generally, you know, was really interested in the more integrative medicine approach to care. Ended up leaving my training in psychiatry, did a fellowship in East-West medicine at UCLA, then came back to finish my residency with this intention of trying to bring some tools, primarily mind-body tools, into my practice. And at that time, there was a lot of interest in psychology world about mindfulness. There's work by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who kind of pioneered application of mindfulness into medical setting by coming up with MBSR, or Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program. That's kind of the key model that people have looked at to bring mindfulness for different conditions, for different medical settings. And when I was becoming interested in mindfulness, there was a program called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy, which grew out of MBSR. It was an adaptation of MBSR to depression, with the idea that mindfulness is this metacognitive skill that can help you catch yourself when your thinking starts to shift into depressive spiral. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to catch yourself before you spiral down, you have the ability then perhaps to pull yourself out of these negative, you know, almost like habitual grooves of depression. So that was really interesting to me and really fascinating. I ended up training in MBCT as well as MBSR. And I wanted to bring this approach to adult ADHD. So adult ADHD was sort of a separate interest of mine, apart from mind-body medicine or integrative medicine. But as I finished my residency training and was doing a fellowship, a research fellowship that enabled me to sort of ask, you know, what is my question here that I want to study? And I have some resources to study that question. I kind of had this aha moment that I want to bring the two together. And this was in the context of having some mentors at UCLA who were also very interested in mindfulness as well as ADHD. Dr. Susan Smalley was one of my mentors there. And it was very, at first, you know, when I discussed this idea with people at the fellowship, they thought this was not a great combination to bring mindfulness to ADHD. Mm. And, you know, this was because people thought mindfulness is meditation. You have to sit still, you have to pay attention. And those with ADHD cannot sit still, cannot pay attention. So why would you ask something that's difficult? But as you know, if you look more deeply, it totally makes sense to combine the two, because it is a practice that can strengthen attention. It can strengthen your ability to be with your discomfort, whether it's restlessness or negative emotions.
And I'm curious, do you see a emergence of the symptoms associated with ADHD? I know that we've had an increase in the number of diagnoses, and there's a lot of views that a lot of people don't actually have ADHD. In fact, I even question that myself. And in some ways, we see an increasing anxiety and depression, and a lot of that ties back to social media use and phones. And so I'm wondering if you have any clear distinction and how you define somebody with ADHD versus the attention disorders that we are having a huge prevalence in that's really just related to technology.
You know, that's a big question. I don't think we know the answer to that, but certainly we do know some things that can help, you know, think this through. We know that ADHD exists in every culture and has existed, you know, going back to there's some descriptions even in the 18th century. So it's not a disorder of just this culture and the fact that we have technology. And we also know that there are, you know, biological markers and it tends to run in families. There's a genetic contribution likely to ADHD. So we do know that this is a kind of biological, there is a, you know, phenotype or that there is a biological contribution.
And I'm sorry to interrupt. Have you heard of the theory that ADHD came from when in our caveman eras that the person with ADHD was the person with high anxiety and they were always running around and that they would alert the tribe if there was danger ahead? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, you may be referring to the hunter versus gatherer kind of idea, or perhaps this might be a little different, but there is thinking that, you know, ADHD is just a variant in population that actually has some specific characteristics that might have been selected for through evolution, that perhaps the person that's more vigilant and can be attentive to multiple things, you know, so that's the hunter idea, that, you know, you can kind of be quick, you can be attentive to quick changes, act quickly. It's more like ADHD, but the gatherer that has to be more systematic and detail-oriented may not be. So that's more the paradigm I'm thinking that has influenced me in terms of, yes, there is this natural variety in our population. And depending on the setting too, the person with ADHD can be more impaired or less impaired. So there's, I think, a lot to be said of having the right fit for what your strengths and weaknesses are. And that's very true for if you have ADHD, maybe a job behind a desk is more challenging than if you are a salesman, or if you, you know, are able to create something as opposed to doing something that's more routine. So there's that component of thinking that ADHD could be a different variation of normal variation. It's a subtype of normal variation. We do have more and more kind of understanding that ADHD also exists on the spectrum. So if you take families with ADHD, you may have some family members that are identified as having ADHD and some that will say that don't meet criteria. However, if you just look at, you know, what symptoms the family would endorse, you will see there's a spectrum that those who are related to someone with ADHD would usually have a higher number of ADHD symptoms that they endorse, even though they might not meet criteria for that. So it becomes this genetic trait, perhaps, that if you, and we know there's multiple genes that seem to be correlating with ADHD. We don't have the gene. We have, it's probably, you know, multiple genes that sort of help provide this sort of phenotype of ADHD. And so it's helpful to think about it as on a spectrum, and depending where you draw the line of how many symptoms you're supposed to have to meet the criteria, then you may, you know, it will change how often somebody's diagnosed with ADHD. And we're doing this now in terms of, you know, if you look at criteria in the psychiatry field, the DSM criteria, we have relaxed the criteria going from DSM-4 to this current version, which is DSM-5. You can be diagnosed with ADHD if you have less symptoms than what you used in the past. And those symptoms don't have to be obvious as a and diagnosable as a child. You know, you just may have some symptoms. Maybe you didn't meet criteria or didn't have the diagnosis as a child. But if there was some evidence of those symptoms as a child and you come as an adult, you can still be diagnosed as having ADHD. So it's a little easier now. So depending on how stringent you are with the criteria, it will really affect who gets to be diagnosed, who doesn't get to be diagnosed. So I think at least, you know, in America, in the US, we have made the criteria more lax. We still look at how much the person is struggling. That's, to me, is a key. How much someone is struggling. You can have all the symptoms, but if you figure out your life, you have enough supports, you have enough other strengths, and maybe the type of work you do, the impairment is not obvious, then you might not be diagnosed. Or maybe even if you understand that this could describe you, maybe there's no need to treat, or you have options of how you treat. And medication will not be necessary. But if you are really struggling, it might be a very different situation. You may need medications. It might be a way to get out of the hole and then actually help you put in other things in place. So maybe later over time, you don't need as much medication. But if you do, it's okay too. You know, is our whole society, is a whole culture becoming more ADD-like, that people have this continuously interrupted attention through technology? And I do think there's something to be said to that, that as the general population is sort of moving, we will also. So the question is, are those who are more likely to be distracted, are those are going to be even more impaired in this culture or not? You know, maybe they're, in some ways, if you are already dealing with, you're more distractible and you have a lot of distraction, at some point there's a tipping point that you either get very, you know, you're struggling a lot, or maybe you figure out how to deal with it sooner, if that makes sense.
Right. And also Cal Newport's recent book, who originally wrote the book Deep Work, he came out with this book, Digital Minimalism, a few months ago, and it was really highlighting the fact that we are having our attention stolen from us by the social media companies and all the app designers who try and design something that is going to hook us, that is going to make us addicted to that app. Whereas even the idea of seeing the little red icon on your screen, there is a psychological trigger that we need to click on that, the notification. And then I remember when I was young and I would have every email pop up on my screen as a notification. And I am still surprised to this day that that is a default option in email. I think you were saying before the interview that you needed to disable that notification. And for me, I can't have any kind of notifications. I even disable my chat notifications. And mm-hmm. I just try and mindfully check my Slack application. And even if that means that I may not respond to people as quickly as they want, but I just know for me is that it makes me in this mode of reacting all day. And then at the end of the day, I ask myself, what did I get done? And I feel like I got absolutely nothing done.
Yeah, I think that's such a challenge for all of us. And I always remind myself, and I think that's an important thing for all of us to think about, is that attention is a resource that's very precious. That attention is finite. We don't have, you know, we can't put attention multiple places at the same time. I have the same quality of attention. So if the environment that we're in is constantly pulling attention away, you end up really being not as effective, and the quality of your attention is not as good. And there's also cost in terms of exhaustion, because every time you switch attention, not there's efficiency cost, but there's also, I think we get more exhausted by that. And that becomes less and less common, that we have these periods of uninterrupted attention, unless we really cultivate that and do some things to protect ourselves, whether it's from these notifications, you know, from your phone and, or, you know, noise even. Some people are more sensitive to noise, so even paying attention to that. But there is a quote from William James, who's a well-known psychologist, talking about, you know, that attention is this resource, this skill that, to me, you know, where you put attention, that's what your life is about. Like, you know, you may be on the beautiful beach, But if your attention is in your mind and maybe rehearsing something that was awful the day before, you are missing out on where you are, on the beauty of the beach in that moment. And we do that all the time. This is human condition. We often are not where we are supposed to be. And that's why mindfulness is having a really a moment in our cultures, because we're realizing that these technological distractions or our own minds that are now so fragmented, or maybe there's, you know, other reasons, whether it's, you know, these social media and the bullying that happens in social media, where we can be so preoccupied and live in our minds and live in our suffering that it's, that's so powerful and compelling that it's difficult to get out of that.
Right.
And mindfulness could be a way to start having some freedom around this.
And in your book, you describe attention like a flashlight. And we tend to turn that flashlight to whatever is distracting us. And we're just moving that flashlight around. And with a certain level of mindfulness, we can ask, should I turn this flashlight over here? Or is this really what I should be looking at?
Right. You know, my personal aha moment was thinking that I can pay attention to attention. It's like, you know, I can pay attention to attention. And it seems kind of simple, but it was really meaningful to me at the time. And that's very much what we're asked in mindfulness practice, is to start noticing where is our attention, what grabs it, where is it going automatically, and the fact that we can bring it back on purpose, you know, with intentionality. So as if grabbing that flashlight and having a little bit more say of where the attention is, knowing that there will be this little bit of a push and pull. You know, there'll still be things grabbing the attention, pulling it away. But the fact that we can keep coming back, it's that training, that ability to control the flashlight, or you could say it, it's like training the attentional muscle, that it's a little bit easier to be where you want to be with your attention.
And now, speaking of attention, there is a huge amount of, America is the number one spot for the ADHD drugs, Adderall, Vyvanse, et cetera, in the world. I believe we prescribe more of these drugs here in America than any other country on earth combined, if I believe that correctly. And so with ADHD medication, I've read that if you're somebody who does not have ADHD and you take something like Adderall, that it makes you really speedy to the point that you actually, in some ways, actually be less focused because you have too much anxiety. And the people who actually have ADHD, they take these drugs and it actually calms them down. I'm curious, since you are taking a approach of ADHD and mindfulness, what is your view of these ADHD drugs? Should we even have them to begin with?
Well, I do prescribe medications myself, and I do think they're tools to be used, and they can be really life-saving for some people, or can really help them understand what it's like to be more focused and maybe less restless. Are there tools to use your whole life? For some people, yes. For some people, no. It may be a tool you use sometime, or maybe, you know, a tool you choose not to because you really invest in other ways like mindfulness or other strategies to help you self-regulate. So there's a role for medications. I do think that we default to medications too quickly and think that that's the main thing we should try, or the only thing you try. And so people get a prescription, but no one talks to them about the lifestyle. Are they sleeping? Are they eating well? Maybe there's not enough education about ADHD and some other behavioral strategies, how to manage it. So I do think it's a tool, but it should be in a bigger toolbox and making individual decisions of when it's appropriate to use it. You know, the medications, yes, there is a sort of a bit of a stereotype thinking that if you don't have ADHD, you take those medications. They don't help you. If you have ADHD, they help you. Well, you know, coffee is a stimulant, just like the ADHD medications are a stimulant. And most of us can benefit from coffee, right? It does enhance your attention and your alertness. So unless you're a person that has quite a bit of anxiety and can't tolerate stimulants, most people could feel some positive effect from a stimulant, as long as the dose is not too much. So it's, you can't really say that if you are responding to a stimulant, you don't have ADHD, because you might not have ADHD and still respond to the stimulant. And that's where, you know, this idea of almost like cosmetic psychiatry comes in, or this cognitive, like in sports, you have doping, right? Can you do this, take stimulants to kind of enhance your performance, even if you don't have ADHD, versus seeing it as a medication that you need because you are at a disadvantage of perhaps having ADHD?
Right. Like, I believe it was pharmacology was the term, where I've read about in articles where they've mentioned about, or designer pharmacology, somewhere along those lines.
Right.
Okay. Articles even about regular people taking Prozac, and people saying that when they're on these SSRIs, that life just feels good and it eliminates that level of anxiety. And there's an increase in SSRIs being taken by everyday housewives as a way of simply calming them down and lessening their anxiety. And I know that's a whole nother conversation, is whether we should be prescribing SSRIs to people simply to eliminate anxiety.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big topic. And, you know, it really comes back to mindfulness in the sense that mindfulness teaches you how to be with discomfort, how to tolerate it, how to learn from it, because discomfort is not all bad. There could be a message for you that maybe you're not in the right place, not a right relationship. Maybe something needs to change of how you're approaching things. So being able to tolerate some discomfort is important. Of course, we're talking degrees too. If there's so much discomfort, so much, you could say suffering, you know, it's the degree of anxiety is paralyzing, or the depression or the sadness is paralyzing, then I think drugs can be very helpful, can help you get out of that. And that's why there is a role for that, but you need to have the bigger picture in mind. To go back to what you said, it is true that for many people with ADHD, if you take stimulants, and that there's a bit like paradoxical understanding to the stimulant, that the stimulant actually doesn't make you more stimulated or hyper, but actually calms you down. So a lot of people with ADHD that take stimulants will say, it does help me focus. It kind of, I feel like I can relax now. There are people with ADHD, and those are often people who also have anxiety, that cannot tolerate stimulants, or it's not comfortable for them. So then we have to look for other options, medication or not medications. And the same is true of people who don't have ADHD. For them, sometimes the stimulant keeps them more focused. For some, it may feel more scattered or agitated or anxious.
And touching on what you mentioned and going back to desire is the source of all unhappiness. And it's interesting, though, when you remember when you're sick, there's only one thing you want. But as soon as you're not sick, you have all these things that you want. And then we strive to achieve them. And that was connecting back to something you said before that.
Desire. I mean, I'm not quite sure how you're connecting it to what I said, but I would say a lot of suffering is because we want things to be different than what they are. And maybe when you're sick, you have more concrete goals of just wanting to be healthy. But when you're healthy, then there's some other horizon that you want, or something else that you want. So we often keep looking for things to be different, or not being quite satisfied with how things are. And, you know, that discrepancy of how things are and how you want them to be can create a lot of suffering. So there's something to be said about acceptance of how things are, even if they're uncomfortable. It doesn't mean you can't have goals. It doesn't mean that you can't strive to improve your situation. But it's really this tension between acceptance and change, that only with like true, even some people say radical acceptance of how things are in this moment or in this period in your life, you can start actually freeing some creativity of how to change things. But if you are, you know, not fully accepting, kind of fighting it, maybe avoiding some feelings about the situation, if you're not fully facing what is, then it actually could perpetuate the suffering.
And I'd like to share something with you is, for a long time, I was taking ADHD drugs and at the same time resenting it. And now, even today, I have this innate drive to always be productive. And everybody looks at me as wildly successful. And in many ways, I have achieved a great level of success. And it did not come easily. And the issue I have today still is if I'm trying to hang out with friends, I still have this voice inside of me that thinks I should be back home working. And I grade my days, I rate my days between a 1 through a 5, but a huge part of that rating is based on how productive was I that day. And say yesterday, for example, I went to the office, I had some great conversations with a lot of great people, and it was a good day overall. It made me happy because I felt like I was a part of a tribe, but I didn't produce anything. I didn't write anything. I didn't produce anything of long-term output. And I suspect that it comes back to when I was a child growing up, I lost my parents, and not having the ability to fall back on my parents' income or whatnot is that I had this fear that I will either be successful as a solo entrepreneur or I am going to be homeless. And I feel that is a drive that has become maladaptive and is hurting me today, where I can't go out and enjoy something for the sake of enjoying it and just being alive and being happy. And for the longest time, I told myself that I didn't say this in egoistic perspective, but I said to myself and others that I'm not trying to achieve happiness. I'm trying to achieve greatness by having an impact and leaving a legacy, et cetera. But then I realized you can't be happy. You can't do those things without first being happy and having that level of self-content and self-love. But I'm still at this point today where I struggle with being okay with not being productive and not having an output and just living day to day. I'm wondering if you have any follow-up questions or if you have any thoughts or feedback.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you already have some insight about this, that you know you overvalue productivity, and that's maybe because of your experience and the fear that you had to face from young age. Right. And oftentimes those young experiences have a lot of power over us, that the fear that you have to be productive in order to feel good. And if you're not productive, you would feel incomplete or bad or fearful that my day was wasted. And so it's that dichotomy, you know, that I think in some ways keeps you fixed in this, you know, am I productive? Am I not? And constantly valuing your day based on that metric. But, you know, trying to expand that a little bit, is a good day only when it's productive? Mm-hmm. Is it possible to also value connection or value recharging and relaxation as important to your well-being? So thinking about well-being as greater than productivity, because productivity is part of well-being. It's important for all of us to be productive. So not throwing it out. But the well-being has other dimensions, you know, including connection, including time to be relaxed and doing nothing, including time to kind of conserving your energy. So when you come back to being productive, you actually maybe have more energy and new insights. It's the idea, as trite as it sounds, you know, that vacation can be very productive because you're away from what you normally do. And when you come back, you can have a new perspective, more energy to tackle those things. You may see things in a new way. So actually being away and leaving something to sit and giving yourself a break from it can be very helpful. It still kind of hooks into the productivity thinking, but it might be helpful for those who really have trouble letting go, you know, of this feeling something has to be leading to something in terms of productivity.
That reminds me of the book called Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. And that was a phenomenal book that describes why we need to get more rest and take more vacations. And I've noted many times myself, whenever I go on a short vacation or a trip, I actually have this little mental model now, is I realize it helps to disrupt the neurons in our brain when we disrupt our typical routines that happen on a day-to-day basis. And I'll come back and I'll try and use it as an opportunity to replace a bad habit with a good habit, because we tend to pick up behaviors more easily once we come back from these trips. But
you know, I think so that, you know, that can be helpful. The other part is just really kind of sitting and maybe in meditation, or perhaps you have the ability to, you know, be in therapy, just kind of thinking about the fear of not being productive, or how to feeling that fear in a way that is not overwhelming. And, you know, there's this like in mindfulness, especially if it's taught in the Buddhist context, there are often these lovely stories that really illustrate a point about some of these attitudes that we bring to mindfulness. So, you know, how you can get over a demon, like a fear being a demon, is you put your head in the mouth of the demon and realize that as soon as you do it, the demon disappears because you've approached it and you've noticed it doesn't have as much power. So that's kind of an analogy of how we deal with these difficult emotions that can be very scary to us. And, you know, fear, no one wants to feel that. And especially if it's, you know, from a young age, it could be really touching into, and, you know, I'm assuming I don't know enough about your situation to really know in depth, but, you know, is there something from the young age that needs to be looked at? And especially with history of traumas and those early traumas, learning to be kind of your own parent, that there's that part, you know, it's not to be kind of a split person, but realizing there's this, still that young person within you. And learning to say, you know, if I were to visit that myself at that age, what would I say to that person? Or how could I give them compassion or some sense of protection or a feeling like I'm here for you? So that's something that's, you know, we do in therapy, is the therapist can model that and can help you connect with that to say, but it can be done in meditation as well. You know, what is this younger feeling that's coming up telling me? You know, there's still part of me perhaps that is scared, afraid of losing everything. And there is this older part of me, the current time part of me, that says, hey, you're successful, you have means, you could relax. But that will not work, or maybe works only sometimes. And then you still slid back into the fear because there is that younger part that you really need to feed with compassion, with love.
Mm. That relates to, I'm a big fan of transactional analysis, which it's a psychoanalytical theory. I believe it also relates to therapy, where it examines a person's ego states. And it typically relates to social interactions about whether the person is approaching it from a parent, a child, or an adult-like behavior. And I found that to interesting, not only in terms of analyzing another person's responses, and I've been able to do that looking at employees and friends and seeing how they responded as if it was coming from their inner child. And then to also be able to do that to my own self, to be able to ask, you know, not only why did I react so angrily, but what was the emotion that came up with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are very much related. You know, for people who have trouble really overcoming feelings, I think working with somebody else can be helpful, especially when there's trauma history. Working with a therapist can be quite helpful. In my personal journey, I lost a parent at age 14. Mm. So, you know, it's different than losing two parents, and was in many ways easier, I think, than your experience. But it was very traumatic to me as well. And so a lot of inner work, psychotherapy, journaling, meditation, to try to kind of understand it. A lot of art too, you know, drawing and art and reflecting on art was really a key for me in understanding that those inner states and getting new information too, because you can only understand so much kind of on the surface, this cognitive level.
I was about to ask as a second question is, there's often when, if we're a child and you get bitten by a dog, and then all of a sudden you have this lifelong fear of dogs, and then we all are somewhat familiar with this idea of having intermittent level of, you know, having a dog and having it be closer and closer to us, you know, and then petting it one day or being close to it, right? And we have that slow introduce to the dog so that we can overcome that fear. And there's another example is that, say I'm at a coffee shop and I order a coffee and I wanted it iced, and then she gives me a hot, and then I go berserk and I yell at her and all these things. And we, you know, maybe we'll look at that person and we'll say that, oh, he has anger management issues. But in reality, maybe it was because it was his wife who he hated for years, and she made him a cup of coffee not the way he wanted it, you know, 10 years ago. Right. And he's held that in. You know, how do you recognize that you're reacting and you have an emotion that is not specific to that situation, right? It's coming out of your subconscious and you don't know it's there.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to do it, because oftentimes these things happen automatically. So there, in mindfulness world, we talk about being on this automatic pilot, and strong emotions, strong reactions, like, put you right in there. And you can, within, you know, milliseconds, be really responding in a way that doesn't make sense in the situation, but it's driven by your prior experience. And so you start recognizing it when the intensity and how you are, like, in checking into your body, like if you're getting really tense, overly tense to what the situation is, or even you feel like, I should be relaxed here, this is not a big deal, but I am not. You know, that is a first clue in a way to say, maybe something else is happening here. What else is happening to me? What kind of trigger may be being set off right now? So I think the body, just scanning the body, noticing your breathing, is it faster? Is it more, you know, are you feeling more tense? Is there's tension in your jaw? Those are kind of cues to us, because the body can know something before you know it cognitively.
Right.
Consciously, the subconscious can really sort of start percolating in how your body is. Maybe you have a knot in your stomach. So those body cues, the body sensations, are really important to pay attention to.
And so I used to have panic attacks, and I would get panic attacks thinking that I was about to die. And it would come on by maybe something I ate. And so now, for example, I don't eat a lot of carbs, but I noticed, like, at some point I ate a lot of carbs and I had a high heart rate. And then I had this little thought, like, maybe it's because I'm having a heart attack or something. And then that seemed to create this roller coaster effect where it shot adrenaline through my body. And then I all of a sudden had this feedback cycle, and I'm getting that my heart's beating really, really fast and my blood pressure is really fast. And so I must be having a heart attack or something. And even though I knew it wasn't the heart attack symptoms. And so I went through this period of having this high anxiety, and it would always be, I would start to recognize that I would recognize this flushing feeling. And now today, if I have that flush feeling, I know, okay, that's the adrenaline being released to my body and I'm going to have a high heart rate. That's nothing to be concerned about. But it took me years to get to the point where I could recognize actual adrenaline being released into my body to then consciously say, okay, my heart's going to be fast. That's going to be okay. And even going through CBT books, and there's are some phenomenal CBT books. I'm wondering even if you can recommend some. And one in particular that dealt with people who have panic attacks. And the thing that I stick to is it gave actual facts about the fact that the human heart can beat at like 250 heartbeats per minute for like 20,000 hours, or, you know, a ridiculously long period of time at a very high heart rate, and it's still going to be structurally sound. And mm-hmm. So in some ways I use the knowledge that I've learned along with the recognizing the emotions and the feelings that come up to then sort of label what that is and to not let myself go down that rabbit hole of thoughts.
Yeah, that's a nice example of how you said the thoughts can kind of get you into a rabbit hole. And there may be a discomfort or a biological shift, or maybe there's something that's happening that's stressful. And yet how we react to it, how we interpret it, makes a huge difference. How we understand it makes a huge difference. And, you know, there is a saying in mindfulness teaching that, you know, pain is inevitable. And I would say discomfort or some stress is inevitable, but suffering is optional, meaning the suffering is what we make of it. Like, we have to put up with pain and some degree of pain. Yes, there's some suffering with that, but we often amplify what's happening through our thoughts, through our catastrophizing in our mind, maybe not understanding what this means or making a story about what this means about me or about the world, that becomes bigger and scarier than what is actually happening. And it, and, you know, that's often how we, you know, we would approach something like panic attack, is to try to help you understand a little bit more so it's not so scary and you don't have to make a more scary story in your mind about it. But that's, you know, that's an analogy for anything in our life. And certainly this also happens when we make stories of ourselves, how awful we are or what this means to fail. or when we let other people's, you know, criticism and maybe bullying get to us and almost take it, you know, that their voice become our own voice. So it's really questioning the thoughts, questioning the stories we tell ourselves, by having some space from it first and saying, these are thoughts. Can I witness them? Can I see them? And then make a choice about it.
And I really love that quote by Blaise Pascal, all of man's problems arise from being unable to be in a room alone by themselves. And I think it speaks volumes to the anxieties and the never-ending runway of thoughts that we have and the inability to be mindful about our thoughts, to have a certain level of metacognition and analyzing where do our thoughts come from. And just like even in politics today, where so many people are influenced and by social media, where they go into their safe zones, into their bubbles. And it was also interesting, even 100 years ago back in the 17, when they invented the printing press, is that there was concerns that this is going to influence people in negative ways as well. But when it comes to, or I guess, the idea of being objective with your thoughts, being an observer. So apart from meditation, I know you would recommend meditation to anybody who's listening. And I'm wondering, sort of a two-part question is, how much meditation do you think somebody needs to do? Or even if it's not meditation, what kind of mindfulness activity should somebody start? And the second question relates to other alternative activities. Like I've done a flotation tanks. And that's, I don't know if you have any interesting thought on that. So meditation, and what are some other techniques to help people with mindfulness?
Yeah. So, you know, meditation is a good way to start. And at the same time, it's challenging. It can be difficult to incorporate into your life. So I often recommend to people to have some experience with meditation. If they can't do it on their own by listening to an app or maybe going to a class, you know, signing up for a retreat, because that's like going away for a certain amount of time. You're in a different environment. You have the support of the group. You have usually the teacher. You get to kind of have this experiment of what is it like to be in meditation for, you know, several hours a day. And oftentimes there's also silence. What is it like to be disconnected and silent for whether it's, you know, 2 days, maybe just even a day, or, you know, a week. I think it's good to have that kind of experience, almost like a little meditation boot camp experience. But if that's difficult or it doesn't appeal to someone, just starting where you can, and maybe it is just 5 minutes of listening to a guided meditation or joining a class for 8 weeks and just trying it out this way. But I'm a firm believer in what's called informal practice of mindfulness, which is having these brief moments, brief shifts in the course of your day, anywhere, anytime, whatever you're doing, just shifting to be more aware of what's happening in that moment.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's actually, from my experience, that's the practice that really sticks with those with ADHD who may have trouble, you know, being consistent with any routine, including meditation routine. And meditation can feel quite boring and aversive, just sitting still. So having these brief informal moments of curiosity, of saying, actually asking yourself, you know, what can I notice in this moment a little differently? And also, what can I notice about what's happening inside? Because so much of our attention is externally driven and taken away from our own inner experience that, you know, we have to be more intentional about moving inward and saying, you know, what am I noticing inside? About my body, about my breath, and also my thoughts and feelings in this moment. So just doing that little shift, you know, and having maybe reminders, you know, having sticky notes or having a reminder on your calendar or on your fridge that says present moment. Or if that doesn't, you know, there's little acronyms in mindfulness practice that I really like. For example, STOP. It's just, you know, each letter tells you a little bit about how to be mindful. So STOP. So pause, T is take a breath, observe, and then proceed, you know, with your day. So just stop and observe, stop and notice. And again, notice what's inside. And, you know, those brief moments can really add up.
Right. That reminds me of, I first started traveling and I was only able to get myself to travel when I told the story I told myself was that I was going to be a photographer and learn photography. And I went to Guatemala and these countries, and I was always in this mode of like, okay, what's the best shot? I've got to get the shot. Oh, the sun's setting, or I've got to be out and doing a long exposure, et cetera. And it was a long time before there was a moment of realizing that I'm not remembering these moments, that I'm just trying to take the best picture. And the time that I remember to implement a mindfulness activity is I was on the coast of San Francisco on the beach and the sun was setting and I was taking a beautiful shot in this absolutely gorgeous scene with birds and people walking on the beach. And I stepped away from the camera on the tripod and I just looked around me and I remember the wind on my skin. I remember the beautiful flash of the orange light and the breeze and the people walking. And I remember that image so vividly because I took a moment away from this mode that I was in to appreciate that moment. And the problem is that we often don't take these times to be mindful. And one of Tim Ferriss's books, Tribe of Mentors, he came to the conclusion that many of the most successful high performer people, they all have some sort of mindfulness routine. And not everyone meditates, but at the very minimum, the one that I remember and that I've incorporated on top of my existing meditation routine is to try and have one conscious breath a day. And now I do that multiple times, even in this conversation where I've been able to just have this conscious breath. And I implement a little bit of the body scan technique that I learned through the Headspace app, where I feel all parts of my body and I ask myself as quickly as I can, what am I feeling? What hurts? What is good? And yeah, it's been a helpful thing. And I would certainly say start out with sticky notes in a way where in some cases you might have to put a sticky note, just like you need to remind yourself to put the keys away. And eventually you pick that up and then it just becomes a part of your routine that just kind of bubbles up throughout the surface.
Right. Great. Yeah, I very much agree. And you know, one breath, and especially taking a conscious breath before something important, can be really helpful. So like in my work with physicians or residents, we often tell them, you know, before you meet your patient, before you enter the room, take a one conscious breath. Because as you could imagine, you know, healthcare settings are very hectic and there's very easy to be stressed and very easy to be kind of caught up in what's next, what I'm supposed to be doing and in your mind. So having these brief kind of anchoring moments in your body, in your breath, and then maybe also intentionally shifting to relax a little bit can change how your interaction goes with the next person. And, you know, you were talking about being in the beautiful scenery and not remembering it as much because you were so focused maybe in your mind in terms of planning and kind of analyzing how to get the best shot, but connecting with senses, right? With the sense of seeing, feeling the wind or smelling the air. Our senses are kind of an antidote of being caught up in your mind. So if we could just say, well, posing the question, like, what can I notice a little bit more with my senses right now? That can really help shift into being more aware. And there are activities that kind of naturally do that to us. And being in nature, like gardening or going for a walk, can more kind of automatically shift you into connect with your senses and be more present.
Right. There's a lot of research that just taking a walk in nature, and there's a great book on Audible that was released about a group that takes people and typically the soldiers who have PTSD, and they go rafting and they go for 3 days. And apparently 3 days of being in nature is enough to help reset and to lower stress and to potentially help remove PTSD as a factor from their life.
Yeah, I know. I believe that nature is like a net mindfulness inducer, right? And also you can, as you are in nature, even enhance that if you're intentional about it. And if you go for a walk, instead of just thinking about what happened yesterday or what's going to happen tomorrow, if you really make the intention, I really want to feel the wind or I want to notice, you can even enhance it more. But oftentimes, you know, you go on a walk, you don't think about mindfulness, and yet you shift to being more present because right. of nature.
And there's a great website blogger whose name is Derek Sivers. And he wrote this blog post about how he would always go on a bicycle ride on the Santa Monica boardwalk. He'd always like try and he would rush and he would pedal really fast and he would just forget and then time would fly. And one day he changed to where he decided he was not going to pedal super fast. And he was able to observe everything around him. He was able to appreciate that bike ride more. And I run here in downtown Austin. It's a beautiful lake and a beautiful trail. And you just sometimes I would just get in this mode where I just start listening to a podcast or an audiobook and I just do my run as if it's exercise. And now there's a particular part that has these beautiful trees overlay. And at least through that one section, I stop the podcast or whatever I'm listening to and I just look at the trees and I look at the nature and the beauty. And I always smile at the end of it. And it just makes me appreciate life and being alive a little bit more than just having this exercise routine where I'm just exercising because I'm told I need to exercise, but taking that moment, right, to appreciate that. And I think simply take more moments to appreciate who we are, where we are, the things we do have, and put aside all the things that we wish we had, then we can live a happier and more productive life.
Yeah, I think it really can shift from stress to these moments of connection, contentment, and you know, more joy in your life. And you were asking me what are different activities other than meditation that can get you there to be more mindful. And you know, we touched on being in nature. I think that's a big one. But you know, anything can be a mindfulness practice. You could do that when you're with children, for example. Children has a nice way of kind of seeing things in a new way and maybe waking you up to shifting maybe out of your own assumptions. It could be being with your pet and just really enjoying and feeling petting your pet. You could connect with your senses anywhere, in fact. But it could also be activities like doing art or writing that when you are a little bit more kind of attuned to what's happening for you or maybe what's coming up, you know, what like kind of connecting with the thoughts or the feelings that perhaps otherwise are not as present when you're busy and doing things. You know, you were mentioning flotation tank. I've never done that, but I think whenever you kind of disorient yourself or are you in a new environment, when you don't have access to the typical mode of being, is a way to kind of open you up to have this openness and curiosity to what's happening moment by moment.
And in your book, you mentioned emindful.com, and I think you also touched on transcendental meditation. And I know that there's tm.org, and then there's another form of meditation, transcendental, and I think that's TM.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any recommendations on where people should go to learn more about meditation or the specific types of meditation or groups and activities?
So there are different kinds of meditation and mindfulness is just one kind and TM is a different kind. There's Kundalini yoga meditation. There's, you know, Christian meditation. There's secular meditation. There's more in this religious context. There's Buddhist meditation. So it really, you know, it depends on kind of what you're seeking. There are different places you can find that. When it comes to the difference between mindfulness and TM, there's some overlap that you may be training this awareness more, but you go about it differently. And TM often will use mantras or words that you repeat to get you to somewhat of a transcendental altered state. Mindfulness is more about awareness and present. So depends of what you are looking for. Both will train attention or primarily focus attention. Mindfulness will also train receptive attention. So more of what I know is mindfulness, meditation field, and you can find classes through MBSR. So looking for mindfulness-based stress reduction classes in your area. University of Massachusetts has a directory of teachers who are trained by them, and that's a nice place to find people who, you know, are good teachers. There are also lots of apps these days. I do like Headspace. I do like Stop, Breathe, and Think. I like Calm, but there's lots of other ones. So just finding the one that works for you. There are many, many books often come with CDs in the back that could kind of help you, guide you through meditation. So those are some ways of finding mindfulness instruction. you know, with mindfulness and ADHD, I do have a Facebook site where I post some quotes and other information related to ADHD and mindfulness. So that's another way if somebody wants to connect it to more to the work I'm doing, which is just typing mindfulness and ADD, ADHD, and Facebook will bring you there. And, you know, certainly I wrote a book called The Mindfulness Prescription for Adult ADHD. So that's a resource. There is another site called Totally ADD, which I really like. It's run by a comedian from Canada that has lots of information about ADD and ADHD in a sort of quick, funny video clips. You can learn a lot. But they also have some resources on mindfulness and how to use mindfulness when you have ADHD. So those are kind of the main things that come to mind right now. But certainly mindfulness has grown so much. And what are your favorite ones for mindfulness?
So I started out with Headspace and then moved on mostly to a YouTube video where you type in 20-minute music meditation and it is Buddhist monks chanting. I never really got into TM of the fact of, you know, I never went to a retreat and I've never actually tried to involve myself in that. And I feel like I should, or it's something I do want to try, but there's just something about the act of having a mantra of having to exhale and say it and then breathe in and then do it again. Although I know that is probably a aspect of that particular type of meditation. But for the most part, I really like the idea of Headspace and that you can choose different themes and he will have an intro that will give you cause for thought on what you should be considering or trying to be more mindful of throughout the day. But I do recognize at the end of the day, meditation is simply the act of doing nothing. And in some ways, you can rely on tools too much, or you can get the Muse headband, which I wrote an extensive article. And I asked a neurologist and a Buddhist monk in the article about what their thoughts on it were. And I feel like in some ways, it can be a crutch, and that you're relying, say, on a third-party machine that's analyzing your brain waves to tell you whether or not you're in the zone per se, which in some ways I feel like defeats the very act of trying to be mindful. But I think in the end, it's still more beneficial than not doing it in the first place. But probably the most beneficial aspect of my meditation routine is that I try and do a great gratitude exercise at the end of that, at the very least, where I think about everything I have in my life, the success, and it fills me with this warm, bubbly feeling, like where they have the version of the meditation where you imagine that you have the ball of sun in your center and you imagine that expanding outward. And for me, I imagine that with the gratitude. And it's just such an amazing feeling to be overwhelmed where you get the goosebumps and you just feel so grateful. And that, I love that. I would not trade that for the world to be able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what resonates with me is that in mindfulness, there's so many different ways to practice. There's a lot of variety of practices, whether it's sitting or walking. And each practice can be done differently. You can do it while you use words, like as you're breathing, you could say, I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. You could just silently watch. You can put your hand on your belly and feel your breath that way too. You can walk and watch your breath. So there's many different ways to do it. You can also then apply awareness to your body and your breath. You can also, you know, have the intention of being more with your thoughts and your emotions, and maybe go back to your breath when you get too lost in it. And you can also bring awareness of these positive emotions and really practice that, because negative emotions will come and, you know, it's important to learn to be with them and to learn from them. But we also need to learn how to connect more intentionally with positive emotions, things like gratitude, which you mentioned, or compassion. Self-compassion is such a key, I think, for all of us, and especially for those who have had traumas or difficulties or, you know, in some ways had felt different or had suffering and maybe were those who are very hard on themselves. The self-compassion piece is such a key. So learning how to saying that to yourself, what if I were more compassionate to myself in this moment? You know, right. Can I connect with that? And there are also, you know, kind of guided practices that can get you there. So I think that, you know, those are the key things I think it's important for someone to say, what resonates with me? What can I do? You know, what is a good fit for me in terms of the practice? And know that that there's not one right way of doing mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I absolutely loved your book. And even if you do not have ADHD, the book is very helpful. And you touch on managing your emotions and achieving your goals. Two things that I'm afraid we just didn't have time for in this specific episode, but I would love to have you back on. But now that we're at near the end, I'm wondering, are there any questions I didn't ask that I should have asked?
Well, first of all, I would love to come back and have a conversation again. You know, I think we've covered a lot. I would say, just as one thing to say about mindfulness, is that it's not easy. You know, that we can have great intentions to do it. We can have excitement about it. We can be good about practicing for some time, and then it sort of stops. We get busy, or we stop practicing often when we really need it, when it's, you know, stressful time, or you maybe need to face something in your life that's the time when you stop practicing. And just having kindness to yourself about that process, and patience with yourself with that process, and knowing that you can always come back, you can always begin again. I think that's important. So, you know, mindfulness doesn't become a kind of a thing that you dread, or you feel like I failed at it, or, you know, I tried it, it didn't work for me. Like I think curiosity is the key here. Like being curious, can I come back to it? Can I try it again? Can I somehow explore it more?
I think it's perfectly well said. Thank you again for being on the podcast, Lydia.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Hey guys, this is Cody again. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Mind Hack. And if you're interested in getting more Mind Hack worthy stuff straight to your inbox, then you might consider signing up for my weekly newsletter. It often contains links to new episodes, blog posts, and other interesting finds I found on the interweb in the past week. It pretty much focuses around productivity and efficiency. So if that's your thing, then be sure to visit my website at codymclain.com. That's MCLAIN.com to sign up. Also, if there are any interesting websites, companies, books, blog posts, quotes, or anything else that was mentioned in this episode, you can find it all and more by visiting the official website for the Mind Hack Show at mindhack.com. And as always, if you have any feedback, good or bad, I want to hear it. Send me a tweet, email, or what have you on either of my websites, as my goal with this show is to give you the maximum value in the shortest amount of time. That's all for now, guys. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you guys again soon.